You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, May 19, 2010, Rick Britton himself delivered a presentation on the Battle of Big Bethel, Virginia's first Civil War land battle. Fought on June 10, 1861, 41 days before the First Battle of Manassas, Big Bethel pitted Confederates Prince John Magruder and D.H. Hill, along with 1,400 men, against Union General Benjamin Butler's force of 4,400 from Fortress Monroe and Newport News. Prior to the fight, D.H. Hill had ordered his North Carolinians to dig in, and it was these earthworks that helped the Southern troops hold the field and prevail against superior numbers. This is the first in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Rick Britton.
Good evening, everybody. How do you like this April weather in May, huh? If you don't like the weather in Charlottesville, wait 15 minutes, and then you're going to get something different. Thanks for coming, everybody. It's great to have such a great turnout on our very first one. This is the first in the series of six running all the way through October, the Civil War Lecture and Day Trip series. And I just want to remind you, if you're not coming with us on the trip next Wednesday, a week from today, it's going to be great. In particular, we're going to see Fortress Monroe, and I don't know if you've heard, I don't think I mentioned it on here, but they're closing Fortress Monroe, and we found out yesterday that it's going to be turned over to, God help us, some real estate folks to develop it. So if you ever wanted to see it, and it really is a place you need to see, it's just fantastic. Come with us on the trip. So that's only one of the stops, Fortress Monroe, but also the Mariners Museum, where they have the turret of the monitor, of the original turret, and a full-scale reproduction that we can get up on and walk around, and a lot of other things. So we're going to see some great sights. So sign up if you're interested. Please come with us. We have a lot of fun on the trips. Ask some of the other folks. And I know a lot of you folks know this, and I know a lot of you have bought one and have read it, and thanks, I appreciate it. But just want to remind you, I got copies of my book on Jefferson. Last year won an award at Book Expo in New York City, the largest book convention in the United States, and it came back with an award. So pick up a copy. I'd be happy to sign one for you. And this concludes the commercial portion of our program. I used to love it when the guy on the radio would say that, so I just picked that up. A lot to go through tonight. This is one of my favorite fights. It's a little bit complicated, so I brought you a map. And I drew another one, and what this is on the board here, and you know, we'll take a break, we'll go about 25 minutes or so, take a little bit of break, and then finish it up. It should run about 40 minutes total, this talk, but as we're getting into it, what this is an operational map. This is the tactical map that shows you the actual battle, but I know in the description about how the forces got there, it can be kind of confusing, and I'm a person who appreciates as many maps as I can get. So take a look at this. Here's Fort Monroe over here. Here's Newport News. Here's the New Market Bridge. You're going to hear a little bit about that. Here's Little Bethel, and here's Big Bethel, where the main fight took place. And the Federal forces that advanced to attack D.H. Hill and Magruder's position at Big Bethel, they came from both of these places. And the idea was almost a two-pronged attack against Little Bethel, and then a concentration of forces, and then on to Big Bethel. I really believe, and I know a lot of you haven't heard this before, but this is really the first major battle in Virginia during the American Civil War. And why do I say that? Well, it's because there were 5,000 to 6,000 people engaged in this battle, and at the time, that was a big battle, just as big as some in the Revolution, and as big or bigger than many in the War of 1812. So as far as they knew at the time, this was a big one. So here we go. On the move since midnight, The volunteers of the 3rd New York Regiment tramped westward through the warm pre-dawn hours of Monday, June 10, 1861. Keep that in mind. It's 41 days before First Manassas. In but a few hours, if all went well, they would surprise the secessionists with a dawn assault. It was to be their first action, and despite orders, their excitement overflowed into nervous chatter. In accompaniment, the long column of fours produced a rhythmic rattle as bayonet scabbards and canteens collided in the darkness. Suddenly, a well-sustained volley of close-range musketry ripped through the unsuspecting New Yorkers. Two cannon added their canister to the deadly hail. Startled, the Empire State boys dodged into the dense underbrush on either side of the road and opened a sporadic return fire. Over 20 of their dead and wounded littered the trail. The 3rd New York blasted away blindly into the dark until it was discovered that their antagonists were not secessionists, not Southerners, but men of Colonel John E. Bendix's 7th New York Infantry. The federal operation against Big Bethel was getting off to a very inauspicious beginning. The action at Big Bethel, Virginia, fought on June 10, 1861, 41 days before First Manassas, was the Civil War's first real stand-up fight. An earlier affair in the mountains of western Virginia had been nicknamed the Philippi Races for a good reason. The secessionists had simply fled their encampment upon the approach of the federal forces. But at Big Bethel, on the Virginia Peninsula, over 5,000 inexperienced Northerners and Southerners traded volleys for the better part of an afternoon. Small compared to the battles to come, no doubt, Big Bethel in the spring of 1861 was a big fight. Bigger in terms of the numbers engaged than many of the battles fought during the American Revolution or the War of 1812. Casualties were few, but the battle was the nation's first inexorable step toward total war. Big Bethel was a quiet country church on the Virginia Peninsula between the York and James Rivers, 13 miles southeast of Yorktown. So keep that in mind. Yorktown, here's the peninsula. Yorktown is just up here, 13 miles away. Site of the British surrender, of course, in 1781, the battle that pretty much ended the American Revolution. Other historical landmarks were close at hand. Jamestown, for example, was barely 20 miles west, and ironically, this self-same peninsula witnessed the landing of Virginia's first cargo of black slaves. In June of 1861, however, the area's most important landmark commanded the peninsula's tip at Hampton Roads. At Old Point Comfort, only 10 miles to the east, southeast of Big Bethel, sat Union-held Fortress Monroe. And it still sits there. But we don't know for how much longer, right? Fort Monroe was a thorn on Virginia's eastern flank. As long as the immense stone and brick structure remained in federal hands, its guns were a threat to Confederate shipping in both the James River and the Chesapeake Bay. More importantly, Northern troops from Fort Monroe could march up the peninsula against the newly established capital at Richmond. For these reasons, the Confederate War Department was anxious to establish a defensive position on the lower peninsula. Enter John Bankhead Magruder. John Bankhead Magruder was a handsome 51-year-old West Point-trained officer. His friends called him Prince John for several very excellent reasons. Magruder was always flamboyantly dressed, and just take a look at that photograph of him. He's wearing just about every mark of command that was legal and some that probably weren't legal by regulations. Every possible thing that he could pile on, he's piled on that uniform. Always flamboyantly dressed, and in speech and manner leaned heavily toward the theatrical. He seemed to ride, for example, everywhere at the gallop. When he first arrived in Richmond, he announced to a startled Governor John Letcher, "Give me 5,000 men, and if I don't take Washington, you may not only take my sword, but my life." His flair for braggadocio, however, was balanced by an active and aggressive nature. In the Mexican War, Magruder had received 3 commendations for bravery. So he's a big mouth, but he comes through every now and then. On the 21st of May, Magruder was given command of the Department of the Peninsula, which included everything between the York and the James. Prince John established his headquarters at Yorktown and went to work with a passion. He reconnoitered, inspected his troops, and began fortifying. Magruder soon informed Richmond that his 2,500 men were not sufficient to block the route of invasion. He needed at least 8,000. His plea for reinforcements was soon answered in the form of the 1st North Carolina Volunteers. The Old North State's 1st Regiment had been organized in the camp of instruction in Raleigh, North Carolina, during the first week of May, 1861. Colonel Daniel Harvey Hill, D.H. Hill, and Lieutenant Colonel Charles C. Lee were both West Pointers, so that was very fortunate in a Southern regiment, or any regiment for that matter, to have the two executive officers be West Pointers. Hill had received two brevets for his service in the Mexican War. Third in command was Major James H. Lane, and he was a graduate of the Virginia Military Institute. These three officers had only recently been in charge of the North Carolina Military Institute at Charlotte, North Carolina. D.H. Hill and the 1,100 well-drilled men of his regiment, so it's a full-strength plus regiment, landed in Yorktown on May 25th. They found the Revolutionary War entrenchments of some interest at Yorktown, but that was ancient history. "We now occupy the point of danger between the enemy and Richmond," reported the correspondent for the Charlotte, North Carolina Western Democrat. This is not playing soldier now. This is stern reality. Facing Magruder's forces on the Lower Peninsula was the command of Massachusetts political general Benjamin Franklin Butler. Major General Butler was a squint-eyed 43-year-old political appointee who had risen to prominence in the early days of the war. And you'll excuse my sarcasm. I'm not really all that fond of Butler. Although he did push later on in the war, to his credit, he did push through the bill to get the black soldiers paid the same as the white soldiers in the Union Army. So that's actually a lot to be said for him. In April, when Maryland secessionists threatened to isolate Washington, Butler, with a few regiments, occupied Baltimore and reopened communications. His independent movements, though successful and acclaimed by the press, so he knows how to get the attention of the press, greatly angered General-in-Chief Winfield Scott. Butler, thanks to strong support in the president's cabinet, was ordered on May 18th to take command of Fortress Monroe and the vaguely defined Department of Virginia and North Carolina. So here's a man in a Republican government. Here's a man who's actually a Democrat, but Lincoln is trying to hold those Democrats in the war with him, right? Butler landed at Fort Monroe with the idea of building on his newfound fame. He immediately began planning grand movements against Richmond. When Scott forbid him from taking action without official permission, Butler, in frustration, turned to civil policy. The rights of Southern property owners in his district were carefully detailed in his orders. Foraging and depredations of all kind were forbidden, recalled Colonel Joseph Carr under Butler's command, and as a rule, generally, were obeyed. But when three slaves owned by a secessionist officer escaped into his lines, he refused to return them. Butler instead classified them as contrabands of war because they had been working on a Confederate fortification. Contraband, thereafter, became the common slang term for Negro or slave. As more escaped bondsmen flocked to his protection, Butler put them to work for the Union this time. Benjamin Franklin Butler, like his Southern counterpart at Yorktown, also sent back many requests for reinforcements. You can imagine the poor people in the war departments on both sides. How are we going to fill all these requests? On arrival, Butler had found that the forces at Fort Monroe included only the regular garrison of four artillery companies, about 375 men, plus the 3rd and 4th Massachusetts Volunteers, which totaled an additional 832. The 2nd New York Volunteers, commanded by Colonel Joseph B. Carr, landed on May 24th. This unfortunate regiment had been issued shoddy uniforms that within days began falling apart. Soon, men from the unit, wrote Carr, appeared on parade with blankets wrapped about them to conceal a lack of proper garments. So this is the fault of somebody who was supplying uniforms to the state government. And the state government didn't have an inspector. They bought all these uniforms, handed them in, and they immediately started falling apart. A story that you hear a lot about on both sides in the Civil War. Another unit soon arrived at Fort Monroe with a uniform of a very different stripe. The 5th New York Infantry, better known as Duryea's Zouaves, wore the gaudy getup of baggy red trousers, short jackets, and white turbans made popular by French colonial troops in the Crimean War. Colonel Abram Duryea's boys practiced loading the musket while lying prone, which is not something that many Civil War soldiers learned how to do or were taught how to do, to fire from the prone position. And they practiced calisthenics, evolutions not detailed in the normal drill manuals. They were proud that the enemy, the Confederates, referred to them as the red-legged devils. Within the next 2 weeks, Butler's force was augmented by the 1st Vermont Volunteers and the 1st, 3rd, and 7th New York Regiment. So he's calling up to Washington, D.C., and they're sending him some stuff down the Chesapeake Bay and the Potomac to him. Colonel John E. Bendix's 7th Regiment wore jaunty, trim, militia gray uniforms. Think about this, folks. Here's a New York uniform in unit in militia gray, not in blue. These were adorned conspicuously with white cross belts. So think about that. Gray background, white cross belts. Theodore Winthrop, as yet an unpublished novelist turned private in the ranks, noted that these were whitened with infinite pains and were a waste of time and offered a most inviting mark to a foe. Think about that. Gray, white cross belts. Shoot me right here. Right here. As Butler's forces grew, he established Camp Hamilton, 3 miles to the west of Fort Monroe at Hampton, and placed Brigadier General Ebenezer W. Pierce of the Massachusetts Volunteer Militia in charge. Additional federal troops set up Camp Butler at Newport News, 5 miles to the south. So let me show you. Camp Hamilton was right here at Hampton. So the force grew at Fortress Monroe, so he started spreading out. He established a camp here at Hampton and then also another camp at Newport News. So Butler is starting to feel his oats a little bit and starting to spread out down there on the Lower Peninsula. Uh-oh. Here we go. Magruder noted the enemy buildup, but was not about to let Butler make the first move. Remember, very beginning of the war, people are probably overly concerned about their reputations right now, right? On June 6th, he ordered Colonel Hill's 1st North Carolina and a battalion of 7 light artillery pieces under Major George With Randolph, and that was the Richmond Howitzers, to an advanced position at Big Bethel. So now the Confederates show up at Big Bethel. Big Bethel Church, also known as Greater Bethel, sat a few paces off the main road, close to where it bridged Marsh Creek on its way south to Little Bethel, 3 miles distant. And now we're already on this map. So as we're talking about what happens there, you can refer to the handout now. It was an admirable spot for defense, and take a look at it, and you'll see what I mean. Despite a shortage of spades and axes, Colonel Hill had his men work all day and night of June 7th. And both of the following days to improve their situation. They constructed a 4-sided redoubt on the north side of the stream astride the road. So don't let any historian tell you, and here's a guy who specializes in fortifications, that it wasn't until 1864 when Confederate soldiers started digging in. Here we are before First Manassas, and they're already digging in, constructing earthworks. They constructed a 4-sided redoubt. The face of the work overlooking the creek was made into a battery covering the bridge, wrote Hill, and Major Randolph placed his guns so as to sweep all the approaches to it. So they dig in, place the guns. Anybody coming this way is going to be hit by these guns. The defenses were strong but slightly higher commanding ground to the south side of Marsh Creek. Uh-oh, it's a little bit higher to the south. Worried Hill, one of Randolph's howitzers under Captain John Thompson Brown from Charlottesville, was ordered there and a small work to protect it was commenced. As soon as his entrenchments were well underway, D.H. Hill began making his presence felt on the Lower Peninsula. Yes, sir?
Could you orientate us on the map to north?
Yeah, north. Yeah, good point. Thanks, because it doesn't have one. North is the top. And you've probably heard me say this before, so I'll say it again, though. If it doesn't have a compass on it and a scale, this one has a scale, it's just a sketch. It's not a map. So this is actually a sketch that I passed out. So north is in the top, so that's the sort of four-sided redoubt. And you'll look just below it across Marsh Creek, and that's that additional one built because it was a little bit higher right there. Everybody got that? On June 8th, he learned... D.H. Hill learned that 2 enemy marauding parties were in the vicinity of Little Bethel, just to the south. Two sorties were immediately organized, Southern sorties, and dispatched under field officers Charles Lee and James Lane. In both affairs, the Federals were driven off. No Southerners were lost in these tiny affairs, but the secessionists boasted that the Federals hauled off cartloads of wounded. The official reports mention no such loss. So that's what you do, is you go check the official reports and you kind of check on what these guys are saying. Major Lane brought in one Federal prisoner, however. A correspondent of the Richmond Dispatch wrote that this ugly fellow from Troy, New York, said he had nothing, and those are somebody else's words, not mine. He had nothing against the South, but somebody must be soldiers, and he thought he might as well enlist. That evening, Colonel Magruder galloped into Hill's camp at Big Bethel and assumed command. Remember, this guy gallops everywhere. Ben Butler was infuriated when he learned of Colonel Hill's actions on his very doorstep. Newmarket Bridge was barely 5 miles west of Fortress Monroe, and that's where one of those sorties went. The Federals were down at Newmarket Bridge. Hill sent these sorties out and drove one party back from Newmarket Bridge. Butler reported that secessionists had been seizing local Union men from the Lower Peninsula, that's a no-no, and forcing them into rebel ranks. Can't allow that to happen. Negroes had been left in charge of farms, they also said. They were being forced into labor on the defenses of Yorktown. Also a big no-no. We don't like that. Worse still, a large Southern force was constructing an outwork at Big Bethel and had reportedly posted an advance guard at Little Bethel, 3 miles to the south. Butler wrote, and you really have to get an idea of the guy, read some of the stuff that he wrote, and the language is pretty amazing. Remember, he's a political officer. He knows how to speak. He knows how to write really well. Butler wrote in medieval jargon that from these positions, the whole country was laid under contribution. Old, old terminology from the Dark Ages. He determined to drive the enemy back from both of these two positions, the little advanced position at Little Bethel and the work that I showed you on the sketch at Big Bethel. General Butler wasted no time in taking action. The following midday, he met with the 5th New York's Colonel Duryea and General Pierce. Together, they formulated a plan of attack for Monday, June 10th. The objectives were the outpost at Little Bethel and Hill's redoubt at Big Bethel. Duryea and his Zouaves would lead off around 2 a.m. by crossing Newmarket Bridge and positioning themselves behind Little Bethel before dawn. So he sends out the Zouaves. They're to cross Newmarket Bridge, approach Little Bethel, and then get behind it. Okay, that sounds like a good plan, right? Get behind the enemy. We're going to capture all of them. General Pierce would follow 2 hours later, so 4 a.m., so it's still dark 30 in the morning, right? General Pierce would follow 2 hours later with a 3rd New York, that's the Albany Regiment, under Colonel Frederick Townsend and 2 mountain howitzers. Another force would march simultaneously against Little Bethel from Newport News to the south. Lieutenant Colonel Peter T. Washburn would command the advance, consisting of 300 men from his 1st Vermont, another 300 from the 4th Massachusetts, 150 from the 7th New York, and 1 field piece. He was to be supported by the balance of Colonel John Bendix's 7th New York, and that's called the German Regiment, a lot of German immigrants in that regiment, and 1 light howitzer. 3 other regiments at Newport News were ordered to hold themselves in readiness. The entire operation would be under the immediate command of General Ebenezer Pierce. And remember, Ebenezer Pierce is a brigadier general, but of the Massachusetts Volunteer Militia. Not a lot of experience with Ebenezer Pierce. And why wasn't Butler leading it himself? Butler ordered that after the two-pronged dawn attack on Little Bethel, the forces were to be consolidated for an assault on Big Bethel, if it was thought expedient by General Pierce. General Butler would not participate in the movement, deciding instead to remain in the rear, from which place he could forward reinforcements and advice as necessary. Aware of the bewildering array of uniforms worn by the Union troops, Butler took precautionary steps to avoid possible confusion. Duryea's Zouaves were ordered to wrap pieces of their white turbans around their left arms. The 3rd New York Infantry procured bolts of white cloth for the same purpose. So a lot of the Union soldiers wrapping white cloth around their upper left arms. The watchword, Boston. Naturally, Butler's going to pick Boston as the watchword, right? Boston was given to the men marching with General Pierce. Butler cautioned that no attack should be made until the watchword was shouted by the attacking regiment. In the excitement of organizing the advance, however, acting assistant quartermaster captain Peter Haggerty of Butler's staff forgot to inform Colonel Bendix of these measures. It was a fatal mistake. Anxious to meet their secessionist foes, the federal volunteers moved out of their camps around midnight. So remember, they're making this move. They're completely green. Hardly anybody on either side has any experience, but they're moving in the darkness. Massachusetts Militia General Ebenezer Pierce and his staff rode at the head of Colonel Towson's 3rd New York Albany Regiment as it approached its rendezvous near Little Bethel. Through the gray of morning, he noticed a large number of men emerging from a dense wood nearby. Pierce later reported that the unidentified force occupied the road, unlimbered an artillery piece — that's not a good sign — and we were immediately saluted by a volley. It was Colonel John Bendix's 7th New York. Pierce and his large staff, Bendix's men later claimed, looked like a detachment of secessionist cavalry in the darkness. The frightened 3rd New York men dove for cover. This is the incident that I told you about at the very beginning. They dove for cover and commenced a straggling return fire. Several shouted Boston above the musketry, but the watchword meant nothing to the men under Colonel Bendix. They hadn't been told about it. After 15 minutes of this blind combat, and isn't this sad, the antagonists realized their costly error. Mortified, Colonel Bendix ordered a ceasefire, and the many wounded were given relief. The 3rd New York alone suffered 21 casualties in this sad incident. And this awful mistake caused another. The Federal advance forces, those units circling behind Little Bethel to cut off the enemy's retreat, the 5th New York, Duryea's Zouaves principally, heard the premature volleys to their rear. Fearing they were being cut off, the inexperienced officers ordered their men to fall back on the reserve. So the whole plan fell apart with this one incident. General Pierce has decided to move on against Big Bethel. At Big Bethel, two small units arrived at this time to bolster Magruder's ranks. Three companies of the 15th Virginia Regiment under Lieutenant Colonel William D. Stewart, 208 men, marched into Big Bethel and were ordered into the advance work south of the creek. They hustled across the stream along with two companies of the 1st North Carolina and took position on either side of Captain Thompson Brown's howitzer. Stewart reported that they completed the slight breastwork. A battalion of Virginia infantry under Major Edgar E. Montague came down from Yorktown and was placed to the west of Big Bethel Church. So they occupied this face of that four-sided redoubt. Facing a branch of Marsh Creek that curved around the southern right, Prince John Magruder ordered Montague to throw up a redoubt. It was supposed the enemy might attempt to turn the Confederate right flank. So even while Pierce is marching against them in that kind of disjointed way, the Confederates are getting more reinforcements and they're improving their position. Meanwhile, at Little Bethel, Brigadier General Ebenezer Pierce was busy reorganizing the federal effort. The firing by the New York regiments had alerted the post at Little Bethel, and the secessionists had fled, so they all got away. Duryea's men destroyed the camp and captured three Southerners who were sent back to Butler for interrogation. Pierce sent for more reinforcements from Camp Hamilton and two additional units. The 1st and 2nd New York regiments were brought up from Newport News, so Pierce himself is getting more reinforcements. Despite the initial fiasco and over the strong protests of Colonels Duryea and Washburn, Brigadier General Ebenezer Pierce determined to continue on against Magruder's redoubt. It was a most unfortunate decision. Around 7 a.m., the 4,400 Federals began the march north to Big Bethel. 4,400. Duryea's light infantrymen took the advance, followed by the howitzers under the command of Lieutenant John Greble, and we're going to hear some more about him, or Greble. You hear it said two different ways, right, Ron? Greble of the 2nd U.S. Artillery. Because of a lack of horses, think about this, because of a lack of horses, these pieces were being drawn by men. The temperature began to rise, and the volunteers began to suffer. They were unused to the physical exertion and for some unexplained reason were wearing their thickest clothing. Their officers should have realized that although the men had dressed in the coolness of night, their greatest efforts would be required under a hot June sun. At a farmhouse along the way, Pierce was told that Big Bethel was garrisoned by some 4,000 secessionists. Of course, that wasn't true at all. It was less than half that number. Major General Ebenezer Pierce, remembering Butler's instructions to fire a volley if necessary, then charge with the bayonet. So that's how he's supposed to conduct this battle. You fire a volley, maybe, but just charge him. Pushed his volunteers forward as he quickly sized up the situation. Most of the secessionists were behind Marsh Creek, which flows virtually west to east, dividing Elizabeth City County on the south from York County to the north. The main road from Little Bethel, also known as the Sawyer Swamp Road, ran almost due north, bisecting the battlefield. So now we're on that battlefield map. It crossed the creek over the county bridge directly under the guns of Magruder's main earthwork. The ground to the right of the road did not look inviting for maneuver. From the roadway, a dense rectangular wood spread eastward. In front of the trees lay boggy fields that drained north into Marsh Creek. A farm lane perpendicularly intersected the main road south of the bridge, and passing to the right behind the woods led to a ford about 1 mile below, 1 mile to the right, to the east. Pierce made his opening dispositions quickly. Three companies of Zouaves under Captain Judson Kilpatrick, the same one who later became famous as Kill Cavalry, were double-timed forward in skirmish order, their lines straddling the road. The rest of Duryea's 5th New York was deployed to the right, with the right-hand companies just behind the woods. Townsend's 3rd New York was ordered to the left, behind the orchard. Two companies of skirmishers under Captains John Butler and Edwin Jenny trotted through the orchard and linked their right with Kilpatrick's left. The three guns under Lieutenant Greble were unlimbered at the intersection in the center of the Union line. It was now 9 a.m. Magruder's Southerners, so all of that was from the northern position, looking north at the defenders. Now imagine we're on the other side, looking south. Magruder's Southerners watched in amazement as Pierce's lead elements came into view. After months of politics and posturing, the war was about to begin right here at Big Bethel. There was no more time for debate. The Richmond Howitzers opened the ball when it became obvious from the number of bayonets visible in the road that a heavy column was within cannon range. Major George Wythe Randolph, Thomas Jefferson's youngest grandson, estimated the distance at 600 yards. Randolph later claimed credit for aiming the cannon that fired the first shot. The bolt from the 10-pounder Parrot, he later wrote, struck the center of the road a short distance in front of their column and probably did good execution in its ricochet. This was a tactic. You see a large body of the enemy, especially a dense formation like a column of fours or a column of companies, and one of the things you do is you bound the artillery piece, the artillery shell, or the bolt in this case, right in front of them so they can see it bouncing toward them. You better believe that gets people to move out of the way, right? D.H. Hill, watching from the main work, remarked that Randolph's salvo had completely broken up the Federal advance units. The Civil War's first land battle was on. Greble's gunners attempted to engage the southern cannon, but their first shots flew wide and high. Major Montague's Virginians felt particularly exposed as their position was nearly perpendicular to the Union gun line. Fortunately for my command, however, wrote Montague, the main part of the enemy shot had sufficient elevation to pass over our heads. One ball passed under my horse between his fore and hind feet. Several others passed within a few feet of his head, and a few buried themselves in our breastwork. Along the Federal skirmish line, the firing began to intensify. The Zouaves answered Randolph's discharges with a cheer, then advanced. Hill's 1st North Carolina peppered the red-legged devils as they came within musket range. The Zouaves pushed forward, wrote Kilpatrick, till we reached a point just on the edge of the woods where the fire was so hot and heavy we were compelled to halt. My men were falling one after another. To the left of the road, the 3rd New York skirmishers had advanced to within 200 paces of the advance works. One company of Confederates replied with musketry from behind the forward works. By this time, General Pierce was beginning to appreciate the strength of Magruder's position. Carrying Big Bethel was going to involve more than just a volley and a charge. And it was probably going to take more than the two New York regiments, about 1,500 men, that he had then deployed. The forces from Newport News, the 7th New York, and the detachments from the 1st Vermont and 4th Massachusetts were brought up and moved into the field on the left behind the 3rd New York. Colonel Bendix of the 7th reported that as soon as his men formed, Randolph gunners opened up on them, striking one man down by my side at the very first shot. His time in this position was short, however. Orders soon arrived from Pierce for his three units to march to the right behind the cover of the woods against the secessionist left. One battalion of the 5th New York, four companies, was filed by the right flank through the timber in support of this movement. So they're already starting to make some flanking movements. While this flanking force hustled downstream, Pierce decided to turn up the pressure on the forward Confederate works, a tactic, by the way, that if successful, would rivet Magruder's attention to the front while his left was being turned. Colonel Townsend was directed to advance his 3rd New York Regiment to the position occupied by his skirmish line. The color guard took its position six paces to the front, and the 650 men of the Albany Regiment stepped out. The 200-yard line of blue passed through the orchard and into the open as if on parade. Townsend recorded proudly, and in the face of severe fire of artillery and small arms, Butler's and Jenny's skirmish companies, meanwhile, were ordered to the left to feel out the secessionist right. Townsend's advance was supported on the right by approximately 100 of Kilpatrick Zouave's skirmishers. Lieutenant Colonel Stewart later reported that many found cover behind several frame buildings and sheds that sat close by the roadway. Stewart said he was annoyed by the fire laid down by these plucky Zouaves. Lieutenant Greble, meanwhile, sped up his rate of firing as Townsend went forward. So the infantry is going forward, so the artillery speeds up its bombardment to support them. His shells plowed through the trees above the enemy works and slammed into the embankments with earth-shattering thuds. Colonel D.H. Hill noticed his men ducking as the cannonballs flew overhead. "Boys, you have learned to dodge already," he shouted gleefully. "I'm an old hand at it." When a loud round approached, he dodged to one side. So he's talking to his boys, and here comes another round. He dodges, pointed his finger at Greble's guns. "You dogs, you missed me that time." The 1st New York Carolina boys, the 1st North Carolina boys were amused at Hill's antics, but were also beginning to seriously appreciate his knowledge of breastworks. Remember, he forced them to dig in. Lieutenant Husk, a lieutenant under his command, noted that some of the boys lying down said, "Colonel Hill knows more about good banks and ditches than we and will never grumble at pitching dirt again." When Townsend's New Yorkers closed to within 200 paces of Lieutenant Colonel Stewart's advanced position, the Virginia secessionists responded with a vigorous fire. The two companies of North Carolinians that had joined Stewart in the forward position, the Hornet's Nest Riflemen and the Charlotte's Grays, isn't that a great name? The Hornet's Nest Riflemen, they leveled their weapons and blasted away over top of the breastwork. Captain Brown's howitzer added a few canister rounds to the deadly reception, but the gun was soon rendered useless by the breaking of the priming wire in the vent. The 3rd New York Regiment shuddered as many of its members collapsed to the ground. Hastily organized stretcher teams began streaming to the rear with their bloody charges. The Albany men returned the fire, but their rounds flew high, zipping through the leaves above the southern position. While Colonel Townsend supervised his ineffectual firing, his two detached companies, and this is about 130 men, slowly pushed around the underbrush on Stewart's right. So can you follow where this is happening? This is this little arrow going around the Confederate right through that underbrush. Federal Captains Butler and Jenny were aided in this movement by a large ravine that wrapped around the Confederate position. The New Yorkers made good use of this ditch. Its steep sides and thick hedges combined to make it as formidable a position as any of the southern mounds of dirt. Secessionist pickets soon detected the flanking force, and they brought news of this to Colonel Stewart. At the same time, on the far Confederate left, so now we're going to go all the way down to the other flank, about 1 mile downstream, some 200 men from the 4th Massachusetts and 1st Vermont, under New York Colonel John Bendix, debouched from the woods and formed ranks. 200 yards to their right front lay a shallow ford of Marsh Creek, defended by a picket force of 40 North Carolinians. The Southerners greeted the New Englanders with a ragged skirmish fire. The defenders hadn't dug in, but were making use of every tree and every shrub available. When the Federals appeared, a swift rider was immediately dispatched to the Confederate headquarters at Big Bethel. Prince John responded by sending Captain William Worth's company of Montague's battalion, the Chatham Grays, from Pittsylvania County, Virginia, to drive back the Federal column. As Worth's men double-timed to the ford, they were followed by one of Randolph's howitzers. Colonel Bendix was overly cautious in his appraisal of the force he was facing. So this is the Federal colonel. And he wasted enough time to allow the Chatham Grays and the howitzer to reinforce the picket post. In other words, if he had just driven right across, he might have gained that ford. Captain Worth quickly obstructed the ford and placed one of his platoons in ambush. The naval howitzer arrived at 10:10. Worth ordered it unlimbered 120 yards up the creek from my infantry, where it had a beautiful range for grape or canister. So he's daring them to try to cross, try to approach Marsh Creek, and I'm going to open up on you with canister. The Southern gunners quickly loaded the piece and yanked off around into the line of Northerners across Marsh Creek. That was plenty for Bendix. He later reported to Butler that his force was not strong enough to make an attack, and after firing some time, withdrew back into the woods. He would see no more action that day. So think about this. All these inexperienced guys, attacking when you're inexperienced is harder than defending when you're inexperienced, a lot harder. So he sees this force. They start firing an artillery piece at him. That's it. I've had enough. The two New York companies moving against the Confederate right flank were much more threatening. So now we're back over on the Confederate right. Their position worried Colonel Stuart. He wanted to remain in the advance works, but his position was steadily becoming more precarious. Duryea's skirmishers were firing from the buildings into his left, while the main body of the 3rd New York volleyed noisily from the open field in front. Thus far, Stuart's five infantry companies, about 350 men, had held up well against the 1,200 deployed against them. Only a few of his men had been wounded, but with Butler's and Jenny's companies on his right, he was now facing the enemy on three sides. Think about that. That's kind of uncomfortable. One quick Yankee rush could capture perhaps Stuart's entire force. When Union Lieutenant Greble began advancing his mountain howitzers, the forward secessionist position became untenable. A message with these concerns was sent back to Magruder. John Bankhead Magruder sent word across Marsh Creek for Stuart and his men to get out. A special passway had been constructed through the bottom for this purpose, and the five companies, according to Stuart, retired in order through the swamp to the second position assigned me on the hill near Bethel Church. Randolph reported that the howitzer was also withdrawn safely. So it got too hot in those forward works. Let's get them out, get them back. And they made it. The Southern withdrawal from the forward battery was closely timed. The impetuous Captain Kilpatrick, who J.D. Cox later described as a wiry, restless, undersized man with black eyes and a lantern jaw, he was watching intently as the insurgents pulled out. Opportunity gleamed bright. A charge was ordered by whom it's not clear. You can't tell from the official records who exactly ordered this. And a battalion of Duryea's men rushed forward. An illustrator later depicted the Zouaves attacking in a column of companies, a massed formation. In all probability, however, the assault was delivered in skirmish or extended order. Greble's gunners unleashed a hail of canister, and the red-legged devils double time across the open field and swarmed into the empty Southern works. Unfortunately, there was nobody there to fight. Vainglorious Kilpatrick later claimed that the secessionists were forced out of the first battery. Kilpatrick also hinted in his report that the 3rd New York was supposed to cooperate in the attack. Colonel Townsend, however, was spending a great deal of time misunderstanding what was happening along his front and particularly on his left. And think about it, in this whole story, how many times do people misunderstand exactly what's going on? During his advance, the leftmost company of the 3rd had been separated from the main body by the thickly hedged ditch. While peering through the heavy smoke, Frederick Townsend saw the glistening of bayonets in the adjoining field and immediately concluded that the enemy was outflanking him. Without attempting to reconnoiter or even contact his flanking companies, for that matter, Townsend conceived it his duty to retire and repel the non-existent threat. At the very moment, therefore, that federal arms were gaining a limited advantage in that forward redoubt, that forward battery, the 3rd New York Regiment was shamelessly heading for the rear. The battalion of Zouaves under Duryea was on its own. Worse yet for Duryea's boys, reinforcements were nowhere to be seen. Isolated and exposed, the four companies of the 5th New York maintained their position only briefly. When the order to retire spread up and down the line, they did so in disgust. An opportunity had been wasted. Captain Kilpatrick wrote that everything promised a speedy victory when we were ordered to fall back. Where this order came from, I just do not know. When you get a good order, everybody claims it. When there's a bad order, it's an orphan, right? Nobody claims it. On Kilpatrick's heels rushed Company A of the 1st North Carolina, the Edgecombe Guards. Colonel Magruder saw the New Yorkers preparing to depart and told Captain John L. Bridgers to go in. The point must be retaken and maintained at all hazard, Lieutenant Huss claimed he heard Prince John say. But Colonel Magruder's orders were hardly issued before the Yankees were double quickly out of the entrenchments and our men into them. This movement, the last act of the seesaw fight over the works, was performed with much bravado, as you can imagine, but without loss. John Bankhead Magruder termed it a timely act of gallantry. Lieutenant Colonel Stewart followed Bridgers with four companies of infantry and another howitzer. So now the Confederates are back into that forward work. The recapture of the forward battery marked the turning point of the battle. We were now as secure as at the beginning of the fight, wrote D.H. Hill later on, and as yet no man, no Confederate, had been killed. That was about to change. When the Zouaves hightailed it to the rear, many of them remained amongst the buildings between the lines. Their mini rifles were soon barking from around corners and upper story windows. Captain Bridgers called for volunteers to set fire to several of those small houses. Corporal George Williams and Privates Henry L. Wyatt, Thomas Fallon, and John H. Thorpe, all North Carolinians, answered the call. They were handed hatchets and matches. As they rushed out of the battery, Wyatt fell dead, pierced in the forehead by a musket ball. The three others were quickly recalled. Meanwhile, on Magruder's immediate left, a strong column of Northern infantry had found another way across Marsh Creek. The Northerners waded through a shallow spot and continued on until they were within sight of the leftmost face of the secessionist redoubt. They quickly formed for the assault. The accounts vary, but in all probability, this was composed of elements of the 7th and 5th New York regiments. They were being led by Major Theodore Winthrop, the promising author who General Butler had promoted and placed on his staff as military secretary. Those in advance had put on our distinctive badge of white cap or of white, had put on a distinctive badge, sorry, of white band around the cap, wrote D.H. Hill, and they cried out repeatedly, "Don't fire." So the Federals come across Marsh Creek and they're yelling at D.H. Hill's 1st North Carolina guys, "Don't fire, don't fire." This ruse was practiced to enable the whole column to get across the creek and form in good order. Companies B and C of the 1st North Carolina Infantry braced themselves behind the breastworks. Winthrop was leading the forward company of Federals as they came into small arms range. Hill and his officers carefully controlled their men's firing. "May I fire?" North Carolinians were heard to ask. "I think I can bring him. I think I can take him down." They were all in high glee, remembered Hill, and seemed to enjoy it as much as boys do rabbit shooting. The Federal return fire was sporadic but noisy. "You can't form any idea of how they hissed and struck," wrote North Carolina Lieutenant Husk, "like a shower of hot stones falling into water." The Unionists advanced confidently up to a rail fence 75 yards from the southern position, mounting the top rail alongside two privates, and you can imagine what's about to happen. Winthrop waved his sword and shouted, "Come on, boys, one charge, and the day is ours." These were his last words. A southern volley felled Winthrop and the two others. according to J.B. Moore. Those following, being protected by the peculiar formation of the ground, were not injured, but upon the fall of their leader, they beat a hasty retreat. North Carolina privates Bushman and McIver later argued as to who exactly it was who shot the Northern Major. It was now about 1 p.m. Brigadier General Ebenezer Pierce and the men under his command were played out. Several assaults had been attempted, and most had resulted in abysmal failure. When Colonel Duryea informed his commanding officer that the Zouaves were exhausted and must be taken to the rear, Pierce decided to retire from the field. Messages were sent out to the many detachments. At that moment, Confederate Major George Wythe Randolph was directing artillery fire against the Federal gun line, which Lieutenant Greble had advanced to a position alongside those buildings in between the lines. During the brief exchange, a southern shell, wrote Randolph, entered a window of the house, increased the fire already kindled, and as I have reason to believe, disabled one of the enemy pieces. This shot also killed Greble. As the Union force began to pull back, Pierce brought up the 1st and 2nd New York regiments to cover the withdrawal. He also ordered the killed and wounded picked up and placed in whatever vehicle could be procured. Many of the Federal dead and wounded, however, were left behind. Winthrop's body was not recovered. The worn-out Zouaves led the hasty march, followed by the 3rd New York Regiment and the forces from Newport News. The Southerners were elated and reacted quickly. Prince John Magruder first detached a company of North Carolinians to clear the woods of the Union sharpshooters, covering the slapdash retreat. Then 100 Southern Dragoons rode out of the works and pursued the Federals to New Market Bridge. The signs of rout were everywhere. And you know what the signs of rout are? Stuff thrown on the side of the road. This is too heavy. I'm not going to use this rifle. Get rid of it. This knapsack is too heavy. That's gone. This blanket's too heavy. Tossing that. Not going to need it. Not even thinking about what's going to happen that night when it gets cool. Big Bethel was a battle of much sound and fury. Staff officers rode on noble steeds, delivered heroic orders, which resulted in a flurry of double-quick movements. Most of the firing, however, was delivered at long range by poorly trained troops. Lots of powder was expended, but few losses resulted. The total Union loss was reported at 76, 18 killed, 53 wounded, and 5 missing. Most of these casualties, of course, were suffered by the volunteer New York regiments. Colonel Townsend reported that his 3rd New York loss, 2 killed, 27 wounded, and 1 missing for a total of 30. But 23 of these were casualties from that friendly fire incident at the very beginning. Duryea's 5th Regiment lost 19 red-legged devils, 6 killed and 13 wounded. A total of 12 casualties were suffered by the 7th, most of these probably occurring during Winthrop's aborted attack. Confederate losses totaled only 1 killed and 10 wounded. But how do you say only one? One is one too many, isn't it? 3 of the last number being members of the Richmond Howitzers. Major Randolph also reported the loss of 1 mule. Many more casualties would have resulted if not for the Southern earthworks. Hill's North Carolinians were particularly proud of their shovel work. After the battle, they shook hands affectionately with the shovels, wrote Hill, calling them clever fellows and good friends. Private Henry L. Wyatt of the Edgecombe Guards became the first of countless North Carolinians to fall in defense of Virginia. Fellow Tar Heel John Thorpe recalled that the 20-year-old lay on his back with one knee up and a clot of blood on his forehead as large as a man's fist. His burial at Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond with full military honors gave the city its first small taste of the horror to come. The results of the action at Big Bethel were many. Several careers were made, and one in particular was destroyed. The new Confederate government was quick to pass out promotions. Hill and Magruder were both made brigadier generals because of their successful defense at Big Bethel. A third participant rose even higher. After Big Bethel, D.H. Hill became known for his hard fighting, much of it against fellow Southern officers and Confederate States President Jefferson Davis. D.H. Hill was cantankerous. Hill was appointed Major General in March of 62 and led his division at Seven Pines, the Seven Days Battles, South Mountain, and Sharpsburg. The following year, he defended the Confederate capital during the Gettysburg campaign. Promoted to lieutenant general, God only knows why, D.H. Hill was sent west to assist General Braxton Bragg, perhaps the only Confederate general who topped him in irascibility. When Hill recommended to Davis that Bragg be removed for incompetence, the president relieved Hill instead. In 1865, Hill commanded a division at the Battle of Bentonville, North Carolina, in which Judson Kilpatrick also participated, and surrendered in that state with Joseph E. Johnson. After the war, he was made president of the University of Arkansas and what later became the Georgia Military Academy. Because of Big Bethel, John Bankhead Magruder, with his flashy uniform and soul-stirring speeches, became the Old Dominion's first great war hero. He was a fitting paladin for Virginia's first spring under arms. He would not last through the second spring. He performed poorly the following June and July during the 7 days' battles outside Richmond and was shipped out west to command the District of Texas. That's what happens. You do bad in Virginia, you get sent out west. When the war ended, he became a major general under Emperor Maximilian in Mexico. The gaudy uniforms and romantic notions of propped-up empire suited him to a T. When this short-lived Mexican venture failed in 1867, Magruder fled to Cuba. He later returned to the United States and made a living briefly as a lecturer. Not much of a living, by the way. He died in a Houston hotel on February 19, 1871. George Wythe Randolph was made Colonel of Artillery after Big Bethel. President Jefferson Davis and Virginia Governor John Letcher were impressed by his abilities. The following March, Randolph succeeded Judah P. Benjamin as Confederate Secretary of War. Randolph's connection to the first American Revolution through his grandfather, Thomas Jefferson, added valuable political weight to his already noteworthy credentials. Randolph resigned the post 8 months later with the intention of returning to field command. Poor health intervened, however, and he left the country to recuperate. He died shortly after the war, and by the way, he's buried up at Monticello Cemetery. Ebenezer Pierce became the scapegoat for Big Bethel. The northern press attacked him with a viciousness he would have been wise to emulate during the fray. He wasn't very vicious. On July 13, 1861, he wrote to Butler from Hampton, "As I have been severely censured by the public for my conduct at Big Bethel, and feeling that the criticisms are unjust, I would respectfully demand a court of inquiry in order that the matter may be fully investigated and the responsibility placed where it belongs." Naturally, Butler didn't want the matter fully investigated. A huge chunk of responsibility would have landed at his headquarters. When the War Department later refused to confirm Pierce's rank of Brigadier General, he enlisted as a private in the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers. From their camp outside of Washington, D.C., he wrote Butler on September 25th that a conspiracy of New York colonels had brought about the disaster at Big Bethel. So at this point, he's just wildly trying to point his finger. "'Twas certainly a singular series of mishaps that ruined me," he wrote, "and probably to a great extent injured you. I cannot help thinking that a man who acted as I did on that occasion will at some time meet with a proper reward." Pierce's proper reward was the dustbin of history. The Northern war effort would have greatly benefited if the Battle of Big Bethel had also ruined the military career of politician Benjamin Butler. Desiring a military fame and yet unschooled and incompetent as a general, Butler held on to command for most of the war. Because of Butler's powerful Democratic connections, President Abraham Lincoln was unable to relieve him until after the 1864 elections. Butler blamed Big Bethel on everybody else. "Everything was utterly mismanaged," he wrote in his autobiography, and you got to read the autobiography. Boy, is that a doozy. "And there did not seem to be a head more than a cabbage head to undertake to do anything except that it might have been Winthrop." His military career after Bethel is a long list of catastrophes and fiascos. He served as a capable military governor of New Orleans in 62, but even that shining hour was ruined by his infamous woman order and his confiscation of $800,000 from the Dutch council. Southerners often referred to him loathingly as Beast Butler and Spoons because of his alleged theft of silverware. Ulysses S. Grant finally removed Butler in late 64. He resigned from the Army the following November. Butler served as a U.S. congressman from 66 to 79 and played a prominent role in the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson. In 1883, Butler was elected governor of Massachusetts, so they loved him back home. The next year, he was unsuccessful in his bid for the presidency, ran for the presidency. Benjamin Butler died in 1893. The Battle of Big Bethel is a fitting metaphor for the nation's overexuberant and unprepared commencement of total war. The troops were untrained and undisciplined. They were led by inexperienced officers. Butler overstepped his authority by undertaking the expedition, then passed the buck to fellow Massachusetts General Ebenezer Pierce. Many of the subsequent problems can be traced to poor staff work. The battle itself was dubious, the battle plan. The coordination was awful. The initial stage of the scheme, for example, was far too complicated to be performed in the dark. Remember, I made a big deal about how these guys are to do this in the dark. Even years later, inexperienced officers found it difficult at best to execute such maneuvers at night. Even worse, however, was that two regiments advancing from separate camps, the 7th and the 3rd New York, were ordered to effect a junction just prior to striking the enemy. Major General Benjamin Franklin Butler had concocted a recipe for disaster. On the battlefield itself, General Pierce showed an incredible lack of vigilance. He dispatched several large detachments, then evidently failed to issue them further orders or even maintain communication with them. Out of sight, out of mind. Under Pierce's own eyes, however, Colonel Frederick Townsend was allowed to pull back after citing the flimsiest of excuses. Pierce highlighted his own incompetence by repeating Townsend's explanation in his own report. In other words, we're being flanked. We're being flanked. Got to pull back. Magruder, for his part, was incredibly lucky in this first battle of the war. He ordered D.H. Hill to Big Bethel, but Hill ordered his men to entrench. In an open field contest, the available Federal forces, enjoying an approximate 4,400 to 1,200 advantage, possibly would have prevailed. Prince John was also fortunate in having determined and aggressive officers under his command. Colonel Hills and Stewart, Major Randolph, and Captain William Worth stand out in particular. The inexperienced volunteers on both sides did about as well as can be expected. Pierce relied heavily on the better-trained Zouaves, and in return, they managed to briefly overrun the advanced Confederate battery. The Federal losses to friendly fire, amounting to almost one-third of the total, could have been avoided. Sadly, Big Bethel was not the last such incident of friendly fire. Benjamin Butler concluded his official report to Lieutenant General Winfield Scott with the following: "I am happy to add, I found the courtesies of civilized warfare have been and are intended to be extended to us by the enemies of the country now under arms, which in this department at all times shall be fully reciprocated." Think about that. The courtesies of civilized warfare. It would be another year before the reciprocation of courtesies ended on the Virginia Peninsula. By the spring of 1862, the numbers of troops and the long casualty list had turned the Civil War into grim business. Then it was time for the braggarts to crawl away and the truly brave to die. Thanks.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.